The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So welcome everybody. I'll just kind of lay out what we hope to accomplish in this session really briefly before we begin. So I'll begin by speaking a little bit about just the recent uptick in attacks on academics and on campus activists since Trump's been elected. Sumaya will expound on this and say a little bit in particular about attacks on activists around Palestine on campus. And obviously there's more to it than just that. But so we'll talk a little bit about what's happening and why. And then we'll try to say something about strategies for organizing against this, ways of fighting back. And at that point, we'll open it up for discussion. I suppose I'll begin by just sort of saying a little bit about how things have been going with attacks on academic freedom, on activists, on academics, and so forth since Trump got elected. Before I say a little bit about, I want to kind of assess the lay of the land, kind of try to sum up all the different things that have been happening, because it's a lot of things that's been happening lately, and it's sort of depressing. Before I say that, I'd like to just offer a couple of prefatory remarks. First thing, obviously it's not new, these attacks on academics. This isn't a new thing, right? It's been going on for quite a long time. The really obvious examples from the past would be, of course, McCarthyism. You could, talk about the culture wars and so forth, quote unquote, in the 80s and 90s. So it's definitely not the case that it's a new thing for the right, various forces in the organized right, to attack left-wing faculty and activists and try to, generally speaking, intervene on campuses. But I think we have seen a bit of a change since Trump's election in terms of attacks, just kind of a general trend of escalating attacks. So. Before I say, I want to kind of go through some of the more prominent cases that have happened recently and see if we can draw out some lessons about why these are happening and what the people that are attacking academics hope to accomplish. Before I do that, I want to say just a little tiny bit about why the campuses matter, why campuses are an important side of struggle, i.e. why these people are even intervening in campuses in the first place. So obviously, campuses play an important role in society. They play a role in terms of socializing and training students to fulfill various roles in society. Obviously, they play an ideological function in terms of generating ideas for society writ large, also training students to a certain extent in terms of what to think about the social and political order that they live under. There's more to say, of course, about their social, economic, and political function, but I think what we've said right off the bat is enough to make clear why the state, why the ruling class, and why forces on the organized right would like to intervene in campuses to see to it that campuses fulfill the function they want as efficiently as possible. And for this very same reason, obviously, this is why the left organizes on campus, because we want to also have an effect on the way people think about society and all the rest of it. So I think there are, so what I'd like to do now is maybe just say a tiny bit more about, so there's one other thing I want to say about campuses and how they're organized. But I think I'll actually come to it when I go through some of the case studies, because I want to say something about administrators and the way that power is diffused within the university. But I think it makes more sense to talk about this once we get some of the case studies, so to speak, out on the table. So the first case, and there are lots of cases that I could have began with, but I'll begin with the case of George Ciccarello Marr. By the way, I had to Google how to pronounce his name, because I've heard people pronounce it about 8 different ways on TV and so forth. But this is right from his Twitter page. This is definitely how you pronounce his name. So as far as I know, it happened almost concurrently with Trump's inauguration. I don't know him, but I'll say GCM, just to kind of not have to say his entire name, for brevity's sake. He tweeted, I'm sure people are familiar with the case, he tweeted, all I want for Christmas is white genocide, hashtag white genocide. And of course, if you're familiar with what this hashtag is about, you'll know that it's entirely the creation of neo-Nazis and racists. And what they mean when they talk about white genocide, first of all, it doesn't exist. Second of all, what they mean is they mean things like interracial dating, intermarriage, immigration. These are things they consider to be white genocide. So this is not a legitimate phenomenon. This is something to be mocked and criticized. So in the discussion, if you like, we can talk about the various different remarks that professors made and how the right kind of seized and exploited these remarks. But I think it's very clear to say, like, in this case, I don't think that there's any reason to kind of back away from the content of what he said. He's mocking Nazis and racists. But I'm sure people are also aware, but if you're not, it's worth talking a little bit about the response from the university. Once it was, some right-wing websites picked up on his tweet and immediately began his campaign of pressuring the administration, just like blasting him online and sending him all these nasty tweets and emails and all the rest of it. And the Drexel administration, so GCM is at Drexel in Philadelphia, very quickly and impulsively came out and said, you know, we condemn GCM's remarks. These are reprehensible. These do not reflect the values of the university. We're looking into the matter more deeply to see, you know, if he deserves to be punished and so on. I think there's a lot to say about this phenomenon already. Number one, the administration has no authority, in my opinion, to weigh in on the content of what, you know, he's tweeting. I mean, it seems to me that the idea that they have the authority to be the arbiters of what's appropriate and what's not is already, it's wrong. The second thing is that they basically, I mean, I would guess unknowingly, caved to a campaign led by Nazis and immediately took up their talking point and went into damage control, and, you know, what they thought was damage control, and, you know, didn't even look into the matter at all. They just sort of took that thing up and were, you know, like I say, probably unknowingly prodded into, you know, punishing a tenured professor. So later on we'll talk about some cases of folks that aren't tenured, who are more precarious. But this is a professor who has the protections of tenure. His administration is saying that he might be punished or sanctioned in some way just because of a tweet that he's made, and their grounds for criticizing him are that Nazis online have created this, you know, online, you know, smear campaign and so forth. So I think this is really alarming on a lot of levels. So that's one really important case. The last thing I'll say about it is that it's ongoing. Even though Drexel was forced, the administrators were forced to back off a little bit from their initial kind of condemnation of his remarks once they got criticized in the media for basically just not even knowing what this hashtag was about. They backed off a little bit, but as we speak, as far as I know, GCM's employment status is still kind of precarious, and it's not clear what's going to happen. And just to be clear, he has tenure. So this is a very worrying case. Another case that we're all familiar with, especially if you were at Kianga Yamada Taylor's opening plenary speech, Kianga gave, as I'm sure everybody's aware, gave a commencement lecture, and Fox News aired this thing, you know, and basically brought out a horde of racist trolls to attack her and send death threats and all the rest of it. A similar case, Johnny Eric Williams at Trinity College posted something on his Facebook about, it was an article about, I don't know that we need to go into the details of the content at the moment, but we can if you like in the discussion. But at any rate, the right, and this seems to be their tactic, they look for things they can easily take out of context and easily use to smear people, and almost all of them, or a lot of the ones that we've seen, this is of course not true of all the attacks, but a lot of the recent attacks have been attacks on anybody whatsoever, anyone who speaking out against racism and white supremacy. So he received death threats, he had to leave town, and he's also tenured, he's an associate professor. He's been told by the administration that he's on leave, that he's not to come to campus, and it's sort of unclear what's going to happen. I'll just actually read you what the administration said about his remarks, because I think it's shameful. So just to be clear about the timeline here, Johnny Eric Williams posts something on Facebook about racism. Right-wing trolls seize upon it, take it out of context, smear him, bombard the administration with smears and so on, and then the president comes out. So I'm just going to read it. I want to make sure I get the quote correct. Of course, course, now it's like hard to bring up now that I'm on the spot. It was right here, I swear, everybody. Okay, well, I'm going to have to come back to it. I can't find it. But that's really disappointing. But it was, you know, it was the same thing. It was the same thing as GCM. The administration said, these don't reflect the values of our university. This is reprehensible. How dare he say these things? And we will see if any policies were violated. Again, the administrator is just unilaterally assuming the role of arbiters of what's appropriate and what's not and so on. That itself is a violation of academic freedom. I don't remember anyone ever electing them or giving them the authority to behave in this way. Mm-hmm. I mean, ideally speaking, ostensibly, this is how they sometimes present themselves, administrators should be the mere servants of students and faculty. But we all know that's not how it works, right? These are unappointed people who make a lot of money, who soak up a lot of resources, who have a lot of decision-making power, and often they're very brand-anxious kind of opportunists and neoliberals who are, you know, happy to throw faculty under the bus if it means sort of keeping a certain version of their brand intact. So this is something that maybe might come up later in the How to Fight Back section, but I just think it's worth, you know, saying right now, having said that you know, I think it would be very unwise for us to assume that the administrators are going to be on our side in this fight, that they're going to stand up for us, that they're in any sense principled when it comes to matters of academic freedom. I think these examples alone kind of show that that's not the case. The case of Dana Cloud is another really important case. So Professor Cloud was at a demonstration, and what the right wing did, this is textbook, right? They seized on a remark she made on social media that was totally reasonable, and made it and did the same exact thing. They seize on something, take it out of context, and try to make it sound, you know, dangerous or something like this. And you know, it's worrying. So there are a number of other cases we could cite. Tommy Curry is a philosophy professor at Texas A&M. Somebody found like an interview and took some line that he said out of context of the very same thing, tried to attack him. His administration came out and said, these don't reflect Aggie values. I guess that's the yeah, that, so, I mean, it's just like they immediately, and this is things that he said 4 years ago, which actually, in context, are completely reasonable, especially if you're somebody that works on, like, white supremacy and racism and the history of those things in the U.S., which are, of course, very violent. It took a violent civil war to smash chattel slavery in the U.S., so it means it's completely reasonable thing to talk about, a topic to talk about if you're a scholar, but here's the president of the administration, again, self-appointed arbiter, what's appropriate speech and what's not, and so on, just kind of coming out, slamming this person, throwing them under the bus, and, you know, basically caving to, again, willingly or not, caving to hard right, hardened racists on the internet. It's not all folks on the internet. How am I doing on time, by the way?
We got about 5.5 minutes.
Oh, good, good, good. So I want to say just a little bit, there are a couple of other cases I want to mention, but I want to say a little bit about who is it that's behind these attacks? I, the way that I see it, and I'm curious to hear from you guys as well, because I think it's complicated. The way I see it, there are elements of the state, because we can find cases where legislators and politicians actually come out and pile on. I'm pretty sure they piled on in the case of GCM. I think they piled on in the case of Johnny Eric Williams. There's a case in Arizona State where a professor taught a course on critical race theory and whiteness, and legislators viciously attacked this person and said, how dare you use our taxpayer dollars for this anti-white stuff, whatever crazy thing the legislators were saying. So there are elements of the state prosecuting the attack. I think that's important to keep in mind and think about what their interests are and what their motivations are. That's really crucial, obviously, if you want to fight back, to understand why they're doing what they're doing, what they hope to accomplish. The media plays a role in this. Kienga outlined that and underscored that in her opening plenary. I mean, I didn't realize this because I don't watch Fox News. Fox News aired part of her commencement address for 4 days during a holiday weekend. I mean, it's not because they care so much about commencement addresses or what Kienga has to say. I mean, this is opportunistic, like, let's sick the trolls on her to silence her. So one thing that I wanted to mention in terms of their goals, I definitely think one of their goals is to silence people. Because there's a chilling effect that happens. I'm sure lots of us can attest to this. Even if you are not the person that's attacked, you see what happens to other people. It affects the way you think about things. It affects the decisions you make. It affects what you say and don't say. And that's exactly what they want. That's what they want. I mean, they want to attack individuals, to be sure, but they also want to chill and frighten and scare off other people so that they self-censor or just totally silence themselves. Because that's one of the things they would like. So there's the state, there's the media playing a role. There are also organizations playing a role. In fact, one of them showed up here earlier this afternoon. So there's a group called Campus Reform, who's very nasty and very, very deliberately, you know, pays staffers to go searching on social media for things to take out of context to then, you know, use to smear people and ruin their careers. So it's organizations like that, and we can name others. I'm sure Samia will mention and discuss the function of others and how they've operated and so on, especially in attacking BDS on campus and so on. And then there's the state, there's media, there's organizations. There's also just a slew of kind of just really nasty right-wingers online who kind of can be used strategically by these other forces to kind of attack people. So when Kianga got like 50 emails or more, like, you know, threatening her, saying awful things, I mean, this is the kind of layer of people I'm talking about. And I think these people in general, we should expect that they're more confident now that Trump's been elected. And you have people like Steve Bannon in the White House. I think there's a level of confidence there. I think they really want to push forward. I think they really want to, like I say, silence, delegitimize the campus left. I think there's also an extent to which they want to build on campus. They want to displace the left. They want the campuses to train racists. They want the campuses to train people to be willing kind of participants in a system that's unjust. They don't want people thinking critically. I'm at time?
2 minutes.
Oh, 2 minutes. Okay, great. They don't want people thinking critically. They don't want people organizing. They don't want intellectuals criticizing the status quo. They don't want any of it. They want either people to just sit down, shut up, and produce, you know, profitable, you know, things that the private sector can use, or they want to train people to kind of be foot soldiers for the alt-right, some of these organizations. So I think that's how I'm thinking about their goals. Both to delegitimize and attack the left, but also to build them, you know, they want to build themselves and so forth. For the reasons that we've laid out, given the crucial function that campuses and universities play in societies in general, but in particular in capitalist societies. I suppose I'll just really quickly wrap up by just kind of, and maybe this will be a nice segue for Sumeya, for her remarks on organizing around Palestine on campus. But I want to say a little bit about the case of Stephen Salida. He was promised a position at University of Illinois, Chicago. I'm sorry, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And I just want to read you, this is actually a quote that came out. This is a quote from an email sent from a donor to the administration of the university. I'm just going to read this to you. And I am going to find this one. I know where it is. Now that I said that, I probably won't. But okay, so here it is. So this is an email sent to the university's chancellor, Phyllis Wise. I'm quoting it. It says, "Having been a multiple six-figure donor to Illinois over the years, I know our support is ending as we vehemently disagree with the approach this individual espouses," and they mean Salida. And the reason they don't like Salida is because he has dedicated a lot of his scholarship to exploring the relationship between settler colonialism in Israel and other settler colonial regimes. So here's a case where wealthy donors, so this is a public school, so this wasn't, you know, like the legislators in Illinois saying, how dare they use our tax dollars or whatever. So these are wealthy donors, you know, threatening to pull money out of the university unless they, you know, if they don't get rid of Salida. And this is extremely worrying. And like I say, there are like lots and lots of other cases I could have named that have a similar mold. It's a worrying kind of uptick in attacks that we're seeing.
Great, thanks, Ty.
Should I go?
Yep, yeah, I see mine.
Great, thanks so much, Tyler. So that's a perfect segue into what I'm going to talk about, which is Palestine activism and how Palestine solidarity activists and groups have been attacked. And the first thing I'll say is that this is nothing new, right? Palestine activists and groups have faced very violent and aggressive attacks for decades. And what we're seeing now, and what's different now, and I'll get more into this later, but what's really different now is we have a president who has invoked Israel multiple times in his speeches, a sort of a model right, for racial profiling, for building a security state, for censorship, and for the persecution of activists. And so we know that it's going to increase, and you know, Tyler laid out how it's already increasing, but for Palestine activists in particular, we're going to see an uptick in the persecution and in the tactics and in the aggression that is used. So Palestine activists have been singled out for preferential treatment and censorship for decades, and campus administrators, often under pressure from Zionist donors and foundations, and state and federal governments, have systematically eroded the rights of Palestine activists and Palestine solidarity groups. And there are so many parallels between the witch hunts that these individuals are facing and the witch hunts that we saw in the 40s and 50s to root out communists and socialists. And I don't want to get into this, but the parallels are really, really striking. This past year alone, I'm just going to give a few examples. This past year alone, there have been so many cases of Palestine activists and groups having their rights violated, whether it was on college campuses or in just in the community. And one example of this is in New York City at Fordham University. Students tried to start a chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine. And the student government allowed them to do it, right? They recognized the group. But then the campus administration stepped in. And it was the first time the campus administration stepped in 10 years to bar a student group from forming. And right now, you know, they're like involved in this really big legal battle, Palestine Legal suing the school, and I'll get into that later. Another example happened at San Francisco State very recently. So on campus at SFSU, that's so hard to say, students, undocumented students, Muslim students, JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, and SJP, among other groups, came together to hold a Know Your Rights workshop. Because there had been so many incidents of harassment and so many threats on their campus, and they wanted students who were vulnerable to attend the Know Your Rights workshop. They were attacked because they did not invite Hillel, which is this Jewish Zionist organization on campus, to attend. To join in the sponsorship. They were welcome to attend. It was open to the public. And so Hillel contacted one of their outside funders, and that funder is suing San Francisco State right now. And they're basically asking for SJP to be suspended and for these students to be disciplined. So they took this wonderful event, this Know Your Rights event, right, that is there to protect vulnerable students, and instead they made it all about accusations of anti-Semitism, right? They took away what the point of it was supposed to be and instead made it about these false accusations that are most likely going to ruin students' lives. Another example, just to show you to what extent this, like, it's violent and gross, happened at NYU this past year. NYU recently had a huge BDS campaign, and their Students for Justice in Palestine chapter received all these threatening emails, and I'm actually going to read one of them. One of them read, "Dear boycotter, we have a very particular set of skills we have acquired over a very long career, skills that make us a nightmare for people like you. In brief, you boycotters should understand, now we will scalp you one by one, group by group, association by association." And this email also included links. And if you click on the links, it basically downloads like a bug onto your computer or your phone or whatever, and it becomes a spying device. And I'll get into that later. And the last example I'll give was at the University of Berkeley, where there was a class on the history of Palestine and like understanding settler colonialism. And the class was approved by the administration, but then that approval was revoked and the class was canceled. And there was a campaign against this, a pushback, where the students who had put together the syllabus uploaded it online and basically decided, you know, we're just going to teach this online. And so many people signed up that the school ended up reinstating it after a long battle. But this just sort of gives you a sense of what we're coming up against. And these four examples are like four of hundreds from just this past year alone. So who is doing this, right? Like, who are these groups? Because there are many. And you know, there are a lot. There are networks of lobbying and watchdog and advocacy groups, groups who coordinate and work very closely with the Israeli state and with the U.S. state and with different surveillance groups in both these states. And I'm actually going to mention some groups, and I'm going to mention the names because I think a lot of these names we actually see around and we don't realize that they're Zionist groups because a lot of them use the veneer of like human rights, right? Or like, you know, cultural Jewish organization, when in fact, or you know, and they use the words education and advocacy, when what they do is persecution and silencing and harassing and maligning and smearing of solidarity activists. So I'm just gonna list a few. Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law, the Zionist Organization of America, Hillel International, which is a Jewish campus organization. If you're here and you're organizing on a campus, you've probably seen it. It poses as an apolitical cultural hub for Jewish students. It's the largest Jewish student group in the world that operates on a college campus. Another one is Stand With Us, the Anti-Defamation League, Jewish Federations of North America, the American Jewish Committee, the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, and the David Horowitz Foundation. There's a longer list, but these are very, very prominent ones that we should keep an eye out for. And, you know, all of these groups have, all these groups work with the U.S. government and with Israel, and all of them have websites and different ways to profile and smear activists. And they're very meticulous. They do their research, so much so that I actually had to use one of their websites to find information about a campaign, a BDS campaign that I wanted to know more about, because I couldn't find it anywhere else. And I was like, okay, well, if it exists, I'm sure they know about it and they've written about it. So they're very detailed. They have a lot of information. They, you know how Trump keeps saying, oh, like the leftists protesting in the street are paid? Well, these people on our college campuses that infiltrate our groups and that work with these Zionist organizations are actually paid. Like, these students are paid by the Israeli government and oftentimes by the U.S. government through funding. And, you know, a lot of these groups have been around for decades and, you know, like I said, have ruthlessly and violently attacked Palestinians. But their strategies have changed in the last 5 years or so. And I think this is really important to point out. So in 2010, Israel launched its Brand Israel campaign. And the idea was that it sort of poured millions of dollars into trying to rebrand itself away from like being seen as a militaristic and religious state and into more of like a modern and relevant state. Well, that campaign failed, and they realized that it failed around like 2012. It also didn't help that they invaded Gaza in 2012, and so they switched their tactics. And their tactics now are just very aggressive, systematic persecution of Palestine activists and all those who ally with them. And one example of this is that in June 2015, this Israeli think tank hosted an anti-BDS hackathon. So basically, they brought together all of these groups and trained them like how to hack into profiles, whether it's social media or other websites. And they actually called it a hackathon, and they like, you know, they advertised it publicly. And I'm just going to quote a Middle East Monitor article, which sort of describes what this hackathon was. So it says, the hackathon was intended to leverage Israel advocates' technological strengths and compensate for their numerical disadvantage. The winning project was the virtual war room developed by students behind the Interdisciplinary Center war room that defended Israel online during the summer assault in Gaza. So these are students in Israeli universities coming together with students in the US that work with groups like J Street, that work with groups like Stand With Us, coming together for this hackathon where they discussed these strategies, and then they came up with this virtual war room. And then the latest incarnation of these McCarthyite tactics is Canary Mission, which is basically a blacklist. It's an online blacklist, and it involves a bunch of different right-wing pro-Israel groups based in the United States. It was launched in 2015 and has since grown to over 600 profiles of students and professors. Most of these profiles are actually of women, more often than not Muslim women. So that's just important to keep in mind. And people profiled on this site are harassed and maligned on and offline. basically what Canary Mission is trying to do is it's trying to like atomize and push students away from organizing. It's trying to exclude them from society. It contacts their landlords. It has contacted employers. It has contacted employers, landlords, college admissions offices, and said, you know, the person you're accepting or the person that's living in your apartment or the person you're employing is a terrorist sympathizer or is anti-Semitic. I can't get too much into Canary Mission, but Canary Mission is like a new step towards what type of persecution we're going to be seeing, this blacklist, and it continues to grow. A week ago, 30 new students were added to it. And they also often tweet at the FBI. They'll tweet at the person that they're trying to, that's the victim, and then tweet at the FBI and say, hey, like, this is a terrorist. And they claim that they're trying to weed out the radicals in the United States. And the way it works is they actually have students or anyone go into the site and recommend who they think should be on the site. So their work is done for them by anyone and everyone. And it's all anonymous. Palestine Legal, this brilliant legal organization, has tried to trace who's behind Canary Mission, and they haven't been able to. And we can talk about more about Canary Mission in the discussion if people want to. I'm just going to skip this. So there are dozens and dozens of examples like these, too many to list. And Tyler mentioned Stephen Salaita losing his tenured position at UC. But I really want to point out that this is all happening because of the growth of the Palestine movement. This is all happening because there are so many Students for Justice in Palestine and other Palestine advocacy chapters all across the country and the world. This is happening because the BDS movement has grown so much in the last 5 years alone. Right now in the United States, there are over 200 SJP chapters. There have been hundreds of BDS wins just in the last 5 years. JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, is the fastest growing Jewish group in the United States. There was a poll that released on July 1st, so it was like last week, that said that the more Americans learn about Israel, the more they don't like it. So clearly, we are posing a threat to them, and that's why these attacks have escalated. And that's why Israel's pouring so much money into fighting us. So I want to move a little bit into why college campuses are the site for all this. And Tyler sort of started to get at this. And in particular for Palestine, the reason most of the attacks happen on college campuses is because college campuses are so important to Israel and to the United States. They're a crucial place for propagating ideas, right? The battle for ideas happens on college campuses. College campuses produce the workers, the administrators, that go out into society, right? So it's very important to win that ideological battle on college campuses. And historically, college campuses have been so crucial in fighting against the state, right? And in fighting against oppression. And there are many examples, like 1930s, 1960s. And that's why so much money has been poured into fighting BDS on college campuses. Stand With Us, which is one of the groups I mentioned, it's a group that claims to be to advocate and promote education and understanding that will bring a secure future for Israel and her neighbors, end quote. Well, it's funded directly by the Israeli state, and it's a watchdog group that operates on college campuses. In 2010, Stand With Us, along with the Jewish Federation of North America and the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, launched a $6 million campaign called the Israel Action Network, and the goal of the campaign was to counter Palestine activism, specifically on college campuses in the United States. $6 million went into this. This is what SJP, BDS, JVP activists are facing. And one of my favorite examples, just because it shows how deeply aligned Zionism is with the ruling class of this country and with the government, is Sheldon Adelson, who's a multi-million-dollar businessman, organized a summit in 2015 that raised over $20 million to counter BDS activities in the U.S. So U.S. colleges and universities work very close with the state of Israel. There are a lot of programs between Israeli universities and American universities. And I'm just going to give a few examples. The first is the Technion University. It's this Israeli University of Technology, and it works directly with U.S. schools here, especially engineering schools, on producing weapons, technological weapons. And most of these weapons are tested on Palestinians before they're exported. So they're tested on people in Gaza and the West Bank, and if they work, they're exported. Technion also grants academic scholarships for ex-IDF soldiers. So if you're an ex-IDF soldier, you can come and study at this Israeli university. And if you were involved in the 2008-2009 massacre in Gaza, you get an extra scholarship. So this is what Israeli universities are like, and this is why it's important to boycott them. And it's not just the U.S. who does this. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security also uses college campuses and universities to spread particular ideas. After 9/11 and the spread of the rhetoric of the war on terror and Islamophobia, the Department of Homeland Security had over 400 campuses with Department of Homeland Security projects on campus that students could get involved in. It was also around that time that Arabic departments and Middle East departments started to pop up all around the United States. And that sounds like a good thing, but it's not, because of the curriculum that they were teaching that perpetuated the war on terror and Islamophobia. And university presidents and trustees obviously also work very closely with Israel. Every year, many of them are taken to Israel on a tour. And they discuss tactics and discuss how it is that universities, U.S. universities, can help promote Israel on their college campuses. I'm running out of time.
So we actually have 2 hours for this session, so if you
okay.
want to extend it.
I mean, I just, yeah, maybe. Yeah, I'll try to, how much do I have left?
About 3 minutes,
okay.
20 minutes, yeah.
I'll just skip some things.
You can extend it.
The next thing is the role of the government in all of this, and Tyler touched on this, but specifically with Israel, state, local, and federal government is very heavily involved in regulating Palestine activism and restricting it. 10 states have already passed anti-BDS resolutions. The state of Illinois was actually the first state to pass an anti-BDS law that made it, what it means is that if any company is involved in BDS, the state of Illinois will not do business with them. And that is a law in Illinois. In New York City, the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, is trying to pass a resolution against the boycott of Israel in New York State. And his argument is that boycotts don't work, that they're not effective, that they're unproductive, and yet he's introducing a boycott of a boycott. So the contradictions are appalling. And it goes without saying that the Democratic Party is very much complicit in this, right? That Hillary Clinton, Obama, just like Trump, have all expressed their commitment to fighting BDS and to fighting, what they say is anti-Semitism, which is actually just criticism of Israel. So the last thing I'm going to talk about is how do they get away with it, right? What allows Israel to get away with what it's doing here in the United States and on college campuses? And the first point, which I kind of talked about already, is just the relationship between the United States and Israel. There's a lot. Israel receives the largest amount of military aid of any country in the world. So when people make that argument of why are we singling out Israel, well, the reality is the U.S. is singling out Israel for aid. We just gave them the biggest aid package yet. And they also export a lot of the technology, the military technology and the tactics here in the United States. So the U.S.-Mexico border wall, the Elbit systems, which is what keeps that border, which is what secures that border, is also what's used in Israel in checkpoints between Israel and Palestine, or the apartheid wall. Another thing is that police departments in the United States often get their training in Israel. So the NYPD, the New York Police Department, has one of its largest offices in Tel Aviv. The LAPD also has this. The police that were involved in Ferguson and in Baltimore, Maryland, were trained in Israel. The tactics that they used were directly from the IDF, from what it had done in Gaza and in the West Bank. So these are, direct connections between the two. And of course, the reality is that Israel is so important to U.S. imperial interests in the Middle East, right? The U.S. needs Israel as a watchdog in the Middle East. And so it's going to do whatever it needs to do. It's going to appease and assist Israel in its colonial project because it has a stake because of its own imperial interests. The second reason, or the second way they go about doing this is just using the claim of anti-Semitism, right, and academic freedom. And the accusation of anti-Semitism, it's still the leading cause of suppression on college campuses. Palestine Legal did a survey and they found that was still the main reason that's used. You know, in 2012, the California legislature passed a resolution which equates supporting Palestinian rights with anti-Semitism. And that's why it's particularly difficult to organize in California, because this is in the legislature. And so the resolution defines anti-Semitism as, quote, language or behavior that demonizes and delegitimizes Israel. There's a lot of room for that to just include anything that has to do with Palestine. Under Trump, it's become a little bit easier to debunk this argument of anti-Semitism, right? Because you have Trump, who often applauds Israel and what it's doing, but at the same time, Steve Bannon is in his cabinet, and at the same time, he completely ignores all the real anti-Semitic attacks that are occurring in the United States. And yet, Prime Minister Netanyahu, you know, has confidently said that Trump is quote, a great friend of the Jewish people. And they've worked closely. So it's kind of pointing that out under the Trump era, I think, will be easier. Outing this accusation of anti-Semitism will be easier. And that's really important for us to focus on because oftentimes on college campuses right now, a lot of the groups that are still Zionist will still pretend to be anti-racist and work on some of these other things. And so it'll be easier to out them when we out what Trump is doing and what Netanyahu's doing, the fact that the state of Israel actually cares very little for Jewish people, right? That in often, more often than not, it actually promotes anti-Semitism and exploits it. We'll skip back to freedom. So the last reason that it's able to carry out these projects on U.S. campuses is the war on terror and Islamophobia. Israel has used Islamophobia and the war on terror to further its own Zionist colonial project. You know, the rampant Islamophobia that we've seen, the idea of the good Muslim versus the bad Muslim, and the Islamic terrorist that is infiltrating the West, all these concepts help further vilify Muslims and paint them as regressive, irrational, violent. And so the Israeli propaganda machine is able to use these to repress and suppress any sort of Palestine activism by saying, oh, those Palestine activists are actually terrorist sympathizers. And of course, it helps that a lot of them are Muslim, and a lot of them work with like Muslim student associations and other things. It also helps when groups like Hillel paint themselves as apolitical and just cultural and religious, because then they're able to say, oh, they are anti-Semitic, they're just attacking us because we're Jews, and they're all Muslim. So clearly this is a religious thing as opposed to a political difference, that one is Zionism and one is anti-Zionism. And that's also why most of the groups like Canary Mission, Campus Watch, use the words terrorist and radical. So Canary Mission, for example, says on its website, the first thing that it says is, help us root out the terrorists of tomorrow. And BDS is often characterized as a violent movement that is deeply rooted in the ideology of terrorist organizations such as Hamas. Today, terror abroad, tomorrow, terror at home. So they use the rhetoric of the war on terror, they use Islamophobia in order to win these arguments. And also it allows them to work with the U.S. government, because that's what the U.S. government uses to go invade Iraq, right, to go invade Afghanistan. So that's also really important. And one good example of this, and I promise I'm wrapping up, happened very recently. Hatem Bazein, he's a professor at Berkeley, and he's the head of American Muslims for Palestine, and Rebecca Vilkormerson, I might have butchered that, who's the head of JVP, one of them is in Berkeley, California, and the other is New York City. And they woke up one morning, and they found flyers on the windshields of not just their car, but every car within a 5-block radius that had both their faces on it and declared them to be terrorists. and radicals. This was in Berkeley and in New York City. And they were never able to find who did this, but this is just an example of how Islamophobia and the rhetoric of war on terror is used by Zionism to further its own cause. And obviously, Zionism is inherently racist and is Islamophobic. And I think we really need to be confident when we say that. It's ironic that they say that Palestine activists are terrorists when you think about all the people that are doing this work on college campuses, all of the Zionist groups that are operating on college campuses and who they are. Most of the Zionist groups on college campuses, many of them, maybe not most, used to be IDF soldiers, right? Are actually complicit in like the murder and torture of Palestinians. And one good example of this is at Columbia University. There's a group called Students Stand with Israel. It's a Zionist group. And a year and a half ago, during Israeli Apartheid Week, when Students Organized for Israel sort of had this like counter setup in front of the apartheid wall. And one of the leaders of Students Stand with Israel, his name is Rudy Rockman, and he is an ex-IDF soldier, a sniper, who was involved in the 2012 assault on Gaza. And this is someone who is a student at Columbia. This is someone who confidently and proudly talks about how he killed Palestinians in Gaza on our college campus. Out on the sidewalk as he's handing out flyers for Students Stand with Israel. And yet the administration has done nothing. Instead, they point to SJP and say, oh, you're making Jewish students feel uncomfortable. Oh, you're too violent. You're terrorist sympathizers. When you have these people who are involved in terrorist organizations on campus, like in classes with Palestinians, with Muslims. So the hypocrisies is, yeah. There are so many more examples, and I'm not going to get into them. I'm actually now just going to shift into, so what do we do, right? How do we counter this? Because they're well-funded, there are so many of them, and they're constantly recruiting. So the first thing I'll say is that the reason they're strong is because we are winning. The reason that they've upped their game is because we're winning. The reason they're afraid and threatened is because we've made tremendous strides. And I think that's really important to point out, that although they're able to target us, although they're able to sometimes make life a living hell and make it difficult to do just daily tasks, they're doing this because we're winning. There are a lot of different ways for us to take precautions, right, as individuals, you know, to make sure your Facebook or your Twitter or whatever is not public and things like that. And although those things are necessary, like, you know, we want to be able to hold out as much as possible, they're not sufficient. The only thing that will really end this is if we work collectively, as a movement, that we bring together JVP, SJP, we tie it to Black Lives Matter, we tie it to the fight for undocumented people, we tie it to the fight for indigenous people here and elsewhere, that we're able to win. And I think that's really important, because often people can feel demoralized or feel like, you know, I can't do this because they're going to target me and then I'm going to lose my job, which is very real. But we are safer when we work collectively, and we're stronger when we work collectively. And they're more threatened when we work collectively, because they realize they can't just pick us out one by one because we're working together. Some really great organizations that have come out of this are Palestine Legal, JVP, which I mentioned. There's right now a Challenge Canary Mission group that's working to get Canary Mission taken offline, which is really great. And at the same time, there are these BDS campaigns that are popping up around the country that are working with other groups on campus. And those BDS campaigns we've seen to be the most successful. The BDS campaigns that work with Prison Divest, that work with Fossil Fuel Divest, those campaigns are the most successful. And I'm just going to give one example from OSU, from Ohio State University. They've had a BDS campaign going for a while, and they recently voted on it in March. And they lost. But it was a huge victory, and I'll explain why. The BDS campaign at OSU was was not just a group of like Palestine solidarity activists. It was Palestine solidarity activists. It was activists around Black Lives. It was Muslim Student Association. It was students fighting for like a sanctuary campus. It was all of these different groups that came together to push for divestment. And the other side, by the way, the other side had $73,000 donated to it just to fight against divestment. And they lost by 200 votes out of about 3 or 4,000 people who voted. They lost by only 200 votes. And so that is just a tremendous victory. And I think the reason they were able to get so far was because they worked with these other groups, because that solidarity was there, that collective struggle was there. And of course, Ohio State quickly reacted by introducing a resolution to ban boycotts on college campuses in Ohio State. That resolution has not passed, but they were very quick to respond to that. And so I went way over time. I'll end by just saying that although we're facing this tremendous and very violent and aggressive war against the actions that we're taking, against the activism that we're doing, we need to really remember that our cause, that our goal is justice and equality. And I think if we keep that there in front of us, then no task will be too big. And it also allows us to build that solidarity, connect those dots. And you know, when we connect these dots, we realize it's not just for Palestinians, right? But it's for Black lives, for undocumented people, for all of the oppressed. And that no movement will win unless all of these movements win. And I think that's really, really important, really, really important to hold on to. And that ultimately, you know, it's an uphill battle, but we're winning. Like, we're actually winning. And we need to really be proud of ourselves and congratulate ourselves for that, because it's tough, because we're working against the millionaires and the billionaires, right? We're working against those who have power. And we don't have power, but we are many, right, Corbin? We are many and they are few. And that's just really important to remember and to hold on to when we feel demoralized, when we feel like, what if we lose our jobs? What if we can't travel? What if we don't get accepted into this or that school? That we're winning, and that ultimately, you know, history is on our side. It's not on their side, it's on our side. If we hold on to that, we're going to win. Thank you.
Thanks, Samaya.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.